You're listening to Reading Writers, a podcast on the joy of reading widely.
Welcome to Reading Writers. I'm Aaron, and today I'm pleased to bring you part two of my conversation with N.D. Wilson. Last time we discussed what's happening with the Ashtown Burial series and the relationship between our enjoyment of fantasy worlds and this one. So if you didn't listen to last week's episode, I'd encourage you to go back and download that one. Today, our conversation continues with his reading recommendations and advice for writers and why Wilson writes scary stories for kids. So let's listen in.
You are known for writing scary or sometimes terrifying stories for a market that is arguably geared toward children.
Right, yeah.
What is it that prompts you to not back away from really going to dark places in your writing? And
sure. Well, two things. One is I do back away from going to the really dark places. Mm. So these stories, these are me backing away, not me doubling down. Now, the reason why I go as far as I do go is because this is a safe place in which children can experience and be inspired by courage, by sacrifice, and really come to grips with mortality and loss and friendship and all sorts of things where, you know, everything's contained. You know, it is safe. It is in control. Mm-hmm. It's like being three and having your dad toss you up in the air and catch you. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of experience. So I can bond kids to really good friends, create great friends for them that share flaws that they can sympathize with, and they see their own weaknesses in these characters. And then they see the characters overcome those weaknesses, and they see the characters sacrifice for goodness and righteousness. They see the characters stand against evil no matter what, resisting the mob, peer pressure, gods, demons, who cares what. They stand for the truth, and they don't ever back down. But they start as flawed little kids, and they end up, you know, as Athanasius. And, you know, like that's ultimately the arc that we'd love to see all these kids have. So how to learn to stand contra mundum. And if you want kids who are going to just grow up and stand against the world, then they need to be fearless. They need to have experienced that, tasted it, seen it a little bit. And this is, you know, I think fiction, storytelling, I think it's all catechisms. You know, all of it is catechism. It's catechism for what you love, what you're loyal to, what you'll die for versus what you'll kill for. Mm-hmm. You know, two very different things. And I think it's a safe space to do that. You serve up, you know, some of the dark flavor, not so they can, you know, be titillated by it, not so, you know, they can revel in it, but so they can fear it and then face their fears to face the darkness. That's really the short answer. It's like to empower young imaginations to equip themselves against the crowd. Mm-hmm. And hopefully when they stand against a mob someday, or when they have some evil in their lives, darkness, hardship, which they all of them will, hopefully this provides some little bit of inspiration, edification, strength for them to do so.
Why do you think so many books, specifically books for kids, tend to shy away from that, from, you know, almost being willing to prepare kids for what's coming?
Because gatekeepers. Because in my marketplace, you can't sell a book to a kid. You got to sell it through moms. You got to sell it through librarians. You got to sell it through teachers. And so you really have to thread the needle with the gatekeepers. The gatekeepers have to themselves be inspired by it and motivated by it and think, yeah, this will be good for them to read. You know, yeah. if they don't think that, then you can struggle. Now, you know, sometimes that's easier than others. You know, sometimes it's pretty easy to get through the gatekeepers and sometimes it's not. And some things get through that shouldn't, and other things should and don't. And it's basically that's the answer. I think a lot of authors bail because they don't want tension. They don't want to answer questions from moms. Mm-hmm. Saying, why did you make Nemione so scary in 100 Cupboards? Why did you do that? And the response is, because I wanted her to be that scary. Yep. She's supposed to be scary. She's supposed to be. Don't worry, she loses. Yeah. Read the whole trilogy. they don't want to deal with that. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to be funny. And honestly, I have no problem with authors who see their role as just making popcorn, mm-hmm. or handing out Doritos. I like popcorn. I like Doritos. And there are definitely stories that are just snack stories. And my kids have them, and we have them in the house. There's nothing wrong with little snack stories. And you can get those through moms pretty easily. You can get those through, because they don't even need to check them. They're not worried about it. Mm-hmm. But when I mean, I've showed up at one public school for a 100 cupboards visit and had a principal tell me I was no longer invited morning of, because one of the fourth graders had a nightmare, had read my book and had a nightmare. And so I was being uninvited and thrown out of the school. So that's what I'm talking about. The reason, so why do some authors choose to not go there? Well, that's why. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I definitely get where you're coming from. There's definitely a place for both, right? Like,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's dessert, you know, there's snacks, there's stuff that's fun. There's stuff that's just flavorful and light and funny. And I love that stuff. And I think I want my kids to read it too. Mm-hmm. On a slightly older age, that's where I put P.G. Woodhouse. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just hilarious dialogue and relational confusion. And it's really, really fun. Like, yeah, it's great. It's edifying in its own way. And then there's, I just want to serve protein. I want to serve big slabs of protein, you know, with a lot of flavor. That's what I want to do.
Yeah. No, that's great. That's awesome. Well, I'm glad that you're doing that, because, I mean, you know, Lord knows we need
meatloaf.
More of that.
That's what I do. Meatloaf.
Meatloaf? Lots of... There you go.
I don't want to be like, so everybody else does popcorn and I do filet mignon. Like, no.
No.
A lot of times I'm doing heavy comfort food.
Yeah.
Or heavy discomfort food.
Yeah. There you go. There you go. Let's not stretch this metaphor too far, because it could yes. It could go to a different kind of dark place pretty fast. All right. Let's switch gears a little bit and let's talk about, we've talked about what inspires you to write. We've talked about what you're writing. We've talked, we've talked about really that the purpose behind writing stories that do actually cause a real emotional response, particularly fear and helping prepare kids for the reality that they are going to face in the world. Let's talk about your reading habits and
sure.
So what does reading look like for you as a writer?
Unfortunately, it's very unsteady and it's sort of a binge and starve system. So I just turned in Outlaws of Time 3 the night before last. And in the last month of writing, I didn't read a thing. You know, I was like, so for a month, I didn't read another fictional thing. You know, I read essays, I read, you know, some history, scripture, but I didn't read fiction. And it's because I'm in the midst of creating it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I'm in a story. I'm in a fictional story. And the last thing I need to do is distract myself from it with a different voice, a different genre, different character. I just need to keep my fingers in all the threads I have and weave it together. But I just turned it in, which means now I'm looking around, you know, thinking like, okay, so where's the stack? And I'm going to binge. I'm going to go binge read. Mm-hmm. And right now I'm going to do sort of a resurvey of some Dorothy Sayers. I haven't read any of hers in a while. I'm going to go back through Lewis's Space Trilogy, some of my favorite books. But as my favorite books, I read them a lot, but I haven't for a few years. And mm-hmm. So I'm going to do a quick lap through the Space Trilogy again. And that kind of thing. And then I'll branch out. And it's also been a couple of years since I've reacquainted myself with the front runners of my own marketplace, with YA, middle grade. Mm-hmm. So like what's currently out there. And I'll kind of like drag my way through that market, you know, touching different things. And like I'm going through a museum, really. It'll be pretty quick, but I'll bounce around. And if there's new authors I don't know, I'll check some stuff out and check out stuff by friends, you know, things that I haven't gotten to yet. But ultimately, I'll build a stack of books. Once I've done all that, a stack of books I think I'll benefit from, and mm-hmm. then I'll start trudging through. And then the draft will come back from my editor. Mm-hmm. I'll stop it all.
Yep.
And I'll saddle back in for another month, and I'll be working on my own draft. And then when I pop out the other side, I click send on that email, back into my pile of books.
Nice.
So that's nice. How it looks.
Cool. Well, that's good. When you've got your pile, is it a primarily physical pile? Or are you a digital guy, audiobooks?
Primarily physical. And then if I'm like airplane books for me are digital.
Okay.
That's about it.
Cool.
So airplane, I could see doing bathroom books digitally, but really just airplane. So I think that the digital book has replaced the disposable book.
Mm.
So the disposable book was sort of like the mass market paperback.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a time when I was traveling a lot on book tour, I would buy a book in an airport and read it on the plane and drop it in the trash can at my destination. So, yeah, it's like buy this, you know, I some author I'd never read, some, you know, number one New York Times crime thriller thing, yep. pick it up, sit in the plane, read it there and dump it. And now I'll just buy it online.
Yeah.
You know, it's like so I'll scroll through, you know, be scrolling through things and iBooks as I sit there on the tarmac. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll have a book in my bag I'm already working on, but
yeah.
If I'm out of gas, I'll, you know, like with any kind of book to read, I'll grab something and then I don't have to drop it in the trash can afterwards. So yeah. For me, digital books are the disposable books.
Okay, cool. Cool. Well, that's probably a better use of money anyway than throwing in the garbage, or at least.
I don't know. Well, the thing that's funny is the digital books are frequently more expensive.
That's true. That's true.
The weird thing. It's like if you walk into an airport bookstore and you pick up one that's a mass market newsprint, you know, it's like you might walk out of there with a better deal.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I've got, anyway, that's tends to be when I'll buy a digital.
Okay.
That's when I'll do that.
Cool. All right. So what was the last disposable book you bought?
Well, this is rude to say.
Sorry. Should we rethink this question?
Yeah, it's there's a book called The Great Good Thing by Andrew Clavin.
Okay.
And I had read his new novel by him called Werewolf Cop in hardcover, but I had never, and he'd been going for quite some time, I'd never read any of his older stuff. So before he converted, you know, I just hadn't done it.
Yeah.
And so I bought two of his novels on iBooks and ripped through them, you mm-hmm. know, really, really quickly. So, yeah. And, you know, one of was True Crime, the other was Dynamite Road. And it's funny because while they're very, very pulpy, very quick, you know, they read like he wrote them in a hurry. Mm-hmm. He's very gifted. He's a very, very gifted writer.
Yeah.
And it doesn't surprise me that he's as successful as he is.
Yeah.
So anyway, but that was just sort of like, okay, here's a guy I need to acquaint myself with his voice, with his background. You know, I really didn't know much about him. I knew of him as a conservative thinker. And then here he is with this conversion memoir. And I'm thinking, but he's doing the conversion memoir as a novelist. I've never read his novels. So I'd read one. So I bounced back and did that. That's an example of, you know, it was quick educational exploration.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that kind of thing.
Cool. Cool. All right. So you mentioned the Space Trilogy as one of your all-time favorites. What is it that you love about that series?
I like the first two books a lot, and they lead up to the third one for me. I really think that That Hideous Strength represents to me everything I want to do, everything I want to accomplish with my storytelling, far more so than Narnia. Mm-hmm. It's not to say no knocks on Narnia. I love Narnia. But for my own personal goals, what the kind of stuff I want to write is That Hideous Strength, mm-hmm. where he mixes a cocktail of mythologies that most people differentiate, that he unifies in his one worldview. And he goes after scientism with Arthurian legend and, you know, medieval cosmology. And here shows up Merlin. And, you know, and he's able to comment on all sorts of aspects of contemporary culture as a result of that. And it's an extremely prophetic book. Mm-hmm. Amazingly insightful into the movements of whole societies as well as individuals, the arcs of individuals through sin and repentance. It's brilliant. It's funny. It's moving. It has the full spectrum of what I think fiction can accomplish. Mm-hmm. And honestly, for me, I put it up there as one of the top novels written in the English language.
Mm.
I mean, it's really, really good. Now it's a genre mixer too. So like, a book like Peace Like a River, mm-hmm. by Leif Enger, brilliant, beautiful, stunning, glorious Christian book, and really like fantastic. But what Lewis did feels to me like it has a higher level of difficulty. And so like, how do you write a story with Merlin in it and a homeless guy mistaken for Merlin and evil eugenicists worshiping demons with a living head that's now been possessed by a fallen star?
Yeah.
And this little circle of, you know, Logris. How do you have such a brilliant woman like Ivy Maggs sitting here tending the house of like the special forces? She's tending house and like slapping around a bear named Mr. Bultitude. So you've got this place where there's just a bear wandering around named Mr. Bultitude, and and he covers like sexuality and marriage, and you know, it's amazing. Like what Lewis does is, to me, the fruit of an incredibly rich mind filled with basically every treasure of Western civilization and more, and the ability to pick and integrate gems from allegedly totally disparate traditions. So I what he pulls off in That Hideous Strength is incredibly difficult and is an inspiration to me. And it is easy when you're writing adventure, fantasy, that kind of thing, to not make stuff as real as he does. So when you are with a company at St. Anne's and you have this group of people who are sort of like, you know, they're there to fight evil, and they're this core group, it'd be easy to make them all spunky and talented and strong, and they all their different talents, and not make it realistic. It's like, but they're actually squabbling over food in the kitchen. And one of the most interesting characters is the woman who has to pick up and clean. And, you know, he kind of follows her. Mm-hmm. And there's one guy there who doesn't believe, you know, he's still agnostic. It's like, and so he's not allowed to go on missions, and he's very angry about it. It's just really funny. I mean, like the way it's very human, it's very, very real, which makes you buy and believe and engage with all their surreal. Everything surreal about it is made real. By it. So anyway, I could go on and on about That Hideous Strength, but it's a fantastic novel. We'll just end it there.
Excellent. Excellent. Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. I started reading that series a while ago, and it was one that I found I had to just sit and really let it take its time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it wasn't one that I could just blast through in a weekend or anything like that. It was like, it was months of reading just little bits and chewing on it and thinking through, which is really unusual for, you know, for a novel.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But I love it. It's such a great series as a whole. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thrilled when that, that new, hardcover, collected edition came out. So as soon as I saw that, it got ahead to my bookshelf, which much to the chagrin of my wife.
Oh, come on.
Well, it's just, you know how it is. Bookshelves.
I probably have 8 sets of that series.
Wow. 8 sets. Okay. Explain that. So you're just like every version of it that you can get, kind of.
Every edition is different. When you're reading a physical copy, like the page you're reading it on, the typeface you're reading it on, the color of the page, the smell of the page, all of it brings a different physical incarnational experience. And so I'm always interested in reading different formats of the same novel and seeing what pops out as new.
Okay.
I mean, just you as a physical being are going to end up engaging with it differently and noticing different things, even based on where a sentence is placed on a page. So it's, yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
Also, I just love them. And so I have lots of
Oh, no, that's great. That's great. But, you know, that's something that's interesting. I never thought about that actually as the fact that you would actually engage with a physical edition, like different physical editions of a novel in specific, differently. I mean,
yeah,
I've kind of experienced that with, you know, the new popular thing right now in Bible publishing is reader's editions and stuff like that. And so they're starting to
get that. Which I was way down with before they were cool, just so you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you take the verse markings out. And you read a book individually, bound individually, separate from the others.
Mm-hmm.
Most reader's editions don't do that. And it's going to impact you differently. Your pace will be different. Your thought process will be different. You'll notice different things. You'll miss different things too, but you'll notice different things. So, you know, doing the both is important.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So we've got one more big question here. I think it's fair to say that at least in certain corners of the Christian world, reading fiction is a challenge. Or to be more accurate, reading anything other than Christian books that align with one individual's theological persuasion can be a challenge. Why do you think it is important for us to read fiction, and how does it help us grow in our faith and in how we engage the world around us?
Well, I think you should read anything that makes you broader, you know, anything that makes you more aware. And so if somebody's hooked on fiction and hasn't read any nonfiction, I'd be saying the exact opposite to them. You know, it's like you're too narrow. So you want to be as broad as possible, which means don't just read fiction, read history. Mm-hmm. It's like I think you should become familiar with history before you become familiar with fiction. Mm-hmm. You should become familiar with the narratives that God has told, the stories he has told in his world before you tap into Shakespeare. But you should tap into Shakespeare. If you haven't read Shakespeare, you need to read Shakespeare. If you haven't read the King James Version, you need to read the King James Version, not just your ESV. If you haven't really read novels, you need to read novels. If you only read novels, you need to read something else. Because our job as image bearers is to imitate God. Mm-hmm. Our job as image bearers is to be as much like God as possible. And unfortunately, we are very narrow and very tiny and oh so finite. So, you know, when we voluntarily narrow ourselves even further, I don't get it. So fiction can be really useful because it kicks down the walls in your imagination. It opens doors in your imagination and enables you to see connections in the real world and in human beings and reality around you that you would have missed if you never read what I was talking about earlier, like something that's been distilled. Mm-hmm. If you never experience something that artistically has been distilled down into something that's really packs a wall up and is like a study of the human character, if you've never read The Brothers K, then you're missing out. If you haven't read Peace Like a River, you're missing out. Like you need to read it because it's going to open up aspects of your imagination and your world to things that God is doing around you. You'll see the wind differently. You'll see it move through the trees differently. And that's the artistry of God. So anything that broadens you out to receive more of God's artistry, anything that makes your vehicle and your receptacle larger so you can hold more, mm-hmm. And widens your eyes so you can see more, I good luck defending yourself against me if you say, no, I don't want to see more. I don't want to be able to hold more. What you're saying, that's just straight up blasphemy. Mm-hmm. So you're saying, I don't want to try to be more like God. So that's it. Like yeah. Full stop.
Wow. There we go. That is the definitive answer. I don't know if I know I certainly can't push back on that, but no, that's great. Yeah, that's really sound advice. We definitely need to, and I do appreciate the fact that you're saying it's not just a question of, hey, Christians read more fiction, but read more everything. And except for possibly schlocky romance novels.
Yes. But romance novels, yes.
Yes.
Read P.G. Woodhouse, read Jane Austen.
Yes.
You have to.
Totally. Totally.
God doesn't tell those stories. Mm-hmm. Like, look around. There's still people here.
Yeah.
There's still more people coming. There's still a lot of romance being written.
That's true.
You know, God's working with it. And ultimately, the entire story of history is a romance novel. Mm. And it's a very romance, especially in the ancient sense, not just relational talky over tea, but romance in, it is a story of a groom claiming a bride from a dragon. Like, okay, it ends in a wedding. Like this is where it goes. We have a bride under a death curse. You know, it's like we have this whole, she's been captured, she's being destroyed, she's rotting, she's falling apart, she's staggering, she's surviving. And ultimately it's a story of love. It's a story of romance, marriage. So yeah, we don't get just to partition our tastes and say, oh, I don't read adventure. Like, well, does God write adventure? Because if he writes adventure, you need to come to appreciate it. I don't read romance. Yep. Schlocky romance, okay, yeah. Check. You know, you don't need to read the cheese queens of Christian art. But you can't get your snob on and be all snooty about things and genres in which God clearly participates to a high level.
Totally. Totally. So, that's great. I think that is a great place for us to wrap things up.
Awesome. So,
Nate, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, this has been great. And listeners, I'll have a selection of links to Nate's books and to some of the other books that we've talked about in here. I'll try and throw in some good classic romance stuff in the correct sense of the word.
Nice.
There too. So
yeah. Hey, one parting offer. I have a writer's course, a short writer's course. There's a lot of videos. Anybody listening who buys Outlaws of Time, can email a copy of their receipt to sam@outlawsoftime.com if they want free access to the writing videos, if anybody's interested.
Listeners, do take that up, because that is a great, it's a great course. It's a great offer. And thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, glad to.
Thanks. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to part two of my discussion with N.D. Wilson on Reading Writers. Tune in next time as I'm joined by Max MacLean to talk about plays, poetry, and C.S. Lewis. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving a rating and review on iTunes. Your feedback really does help people find the show. You can find me on Twitter at Aaron Strongarm, and for more content, including reading recommendations, please visit bloggingtheologically.com.